Music session number 10667, Reel 1.
Wing Commander Devitt, Reel 1. Can you tell me how you came to be in the Air Force in the first place, please?
Well, that is quite a long story, because I was out in Kenya farming coffee in 1929-1930, and I met a man who was the senior flying instructor at the Cambridge Air Squadron, who had a puncture in his car. So I helped him mend the puncture in Nairobi of his car, and he discovered he knew my name because he taught my brother to fly in the Cambridge Air Squadron. Now, we were talking, and he said, as a matter of fact, he was now the pilot for Honourable Freddie Guest, who had two Hawker Tomtit aircraft down at the aerodrome, Wilson's Airfield in Nairobi. Would I like to come, as he had to do a flying test? I went down with him, and he flew me all around the skies and so on. And from then, I just felt that I had to learn to fly. I came back from Kenya in 1931, learned to fly privately, and then realized that I could join the Royal Air Force, you'll have to check this one. RAF Reserve of Officers. And then I could learn to fly the aircraft used by the Air Force, modern aircraft. And this really set me going again. And we flew Bristol fighters and a thing called a preliminary training machine, which had a small engine of three cylinders and would hardly take off with two people up. And I found that I was told to do a loop-the-loop by myself, as it wouldn't go over the top with two people on board. Anyway, I thoroughly enjoyed flying these aeroplanes, and then enjoyed it so much that I felt I wanted to do more than the short period per annum. And I found out there was a thing called the Auxiliary Air Force. And I was very lucky because I was the first person who had learnt to fly, accepted to start all over again as a pilot in the Auxiliary Air Force. And I was accepted in 600 City of London Squadron. I then stayed with them until the outbreak of war.
You were telling me earlier that you were very proud to have been in the Auxiliary Air Force. Can you tell me why?
Well, it was a... I think anybody who joined the Royal Auxiliary Air Force should be very proud indeed to have ever been accepted to join the Royal Auxiliary Air Force. It was not an easy thing to get into, and there weren't a great number of us. There were only at that time, as far as I can remember, 601, 2, 3, 4... 5 Birmingham, 5, 6 Liverpool, 8, 9 squadrons. There were 9 squadrons in all, of which there were 12 to 15 pilots. So that doesn't add up to very many people who were lucky enough to be brought into the realms of the Auxiliary Air Force. That's why I'm proud to be a member of it, having been a member of it.
You joined at a time when very rapid changes were taking place in the Air Force with the lead-up to the Second World War. Can you tell me what you remember of the changes in equipment that came in?
Well, we started off with Westland Wapiti aircraft. And then we got Hawker Hearts, which were modern aeroplanes in 1933. And very good and very pleasant aeroplanes to fly. We then were re-equipped with Hawker Demons, which is virtually the Hawker Heart, but with a few added additions to it. Then we went on to Blenheims, Blenheim 1s, twin engines, Hawker, Bristol. And they were supposed to be used by us as twin-engine fighters. Well, there any could have been a worse aeroplane than that. For a fighter aeroplane is difficult to imagine. But they were never used as that, and they went back to their business of bombing. We had those at the very outbreak of war.
Were they relatively carefree and uncircumscribed days of flying then, as compared with what came later?
Well, the Bristol Blenheim, of course, was the most up-to-date aeroplane that we had up to then. There were it was a squadron of Spitfires and a squadron of Hurricanes, yes, in 1938.
But I was thinking of the kind of red tape that came later in post-war years.
Well, there's always been red tape in the Air Force. There's red tape in the Army and the Navy and everything. But I wouldn't have thought that we had more red tape than any other service.
You were a pretty junior officer in those days, but were you conscious of the growing strength of the Luftwaffe at that time?
Oh, heavens, yes. 1935 we began to realize that the war was coming. And, well, we were warned in so many different ways, actually, of flying training and so on, that it was going to come at some time or another. I promoted to flight lieutenant in 1935. And I was a squadron leader at the outbreak of war.
Do you remember any particular individuals who especially pointed out the danger of Germany? Either in the Air Force or outside?
Well, we had, of course, Air Chief Marshals and people visit us from time to time, who gave us lectures and so on. Maybe I should tell you what the Auxiliary Air Force meant to start with, to show you that we were keeping up to it, the same with the regular Air Force. We did as many hours per year as the regular Air Force did, actually. For instance, I give you a week actually. Monday night, for instance, after having worked in the city all day, we had town headquarters where we had a lecture and we had dinner in our mess at Finsbury Barracks in the city of London. On the Thursday night, it was the same thing. We had a lecture on the Thursday night, and in the summer, we used to drive out to Hendon and we used to fly in the evenings rather than have lectures, then have supper and then drive home afterwards. Saturday, in those days, not today, it doesn't seem to happen, but in those days one used to work on Saturday mornings at Lloyd's, and you didn't get away till 12 o'clock when I used to fly out or drive out to Hendon, and we used to fly throughout the whole afternoon. Stay the night in the mess at Hendon and fly from any time in the morning for the whole of that day until it got dusk. And then one used to drive home and up to work again on the Monday. And so it went on throughout the week. We had a fortnight's camp, and the places we went to, as I can remember, more than anywhere else, was Tangmere. Lovely station, absolutely by Chichester. Tangmere. We went to Hawkins in Kent. We went up to Sutton Bridge for armament training, and we went down to Warmall for armament training in 1938. So, you see, during that time, we didn't have very much time to ourselves, as most people did, like playing tennis at home and weekends and all that sort of thing. One was literally working all the time. We did far more than the Territorial Army in that respect. The Auxiliary Air Force, we really did work hard, and my God, we enjoyed it too.
Did Did you actually hear Chamberlain's broadcast in which he announced war with Germany?
I certainly did, yes. I was a Tangmei at the time, as a squadron leader, and I remember it only too well on the 3rd of September 1939, yeah.
Can you set the scene of...
Well, when you say set the scene, I remember that we were sitting in the mess anteroom at Tangmei, and at 11 o'clock he announced that he was now, got it in there, announced that we're now considered we're at war with Germany. That I remember very well indeed.
What kind of impact did it make on everybody?
We knew it was coming. No way about it.
Were you dismayed, or were you philosophical, or what?
No, I think probably the same as everybody was in the 1914 war when that one started. I was alive then, but I only know but what I've heard from people that one was anxious to get on with it and get the war over.
At that time, in September 1939, what did you think the RAF's chances against the Luftwaffe would be?
Well, we were desperately frightened, obviously, for a simple reason that they'd been into Poland, they'd been in Czechoslovakia, and they had laid waste in those countries completely and utterly, and they hadn't anything against them. So we didn't know what we were up against. But then, of course, as it went on, right, till Dunkirk, nothing happened at all. And so we just went on flying as we had in pre-war.
There was a notorious incident, I think, at the beginning of the war, which you may have heard of, called the Battle of Barking Creek.
Yes, if it's the one I'm thinking of, I've certainly heard of that one, but it was on the next morning at Tangmei, number one squadron, no, not one squadron, a big squadron, 43 squadron, were ordered out on a scramble to intercept a raid coming up the channel. Up the Thames Channel. And I remember them very well coming back as it was dusk. They went out before dusk, actually. And they were coming back. And I remember we'd had the air raid warning and we've all been warned we've got to put on our gas masks and have our clothes ready to jump into if anything happened. And I remember looking out of the window of my room and trying to struggle with my gas mask and everything, and I saw a hurricane coming over, straight over the head of the mess, over the top of the mess. And I thought to my God, here it is. I can remember that very clearly. And of course it wasn't. It was merely one of the hurricanes returning to Tangmei from having gone up on the scramble.
So, your particular squadron... At Tangmei was
where? Oh, no, I hadn't got a squadron then. No, I was the senior controller in the ops room. I was promoted to squadron leader and put to that job, which I went down to on it would have been the 1st of September.
Can you tell me about the work of a controller?
Well, a controller, really, it was a controller on a section, a sector controller, as we were controlled by 11 group. And 11 group would get all the information and more that we were getting on our plotting board. And they, the group, then would call... one section at readiness, or one squadron at readiness, or whatever it was that they wanted to be at readiness. And that meant you had 2 minutes to get off the ground. So people used to go and sit, the pilots used to go and sit in the aircraft and wait for the call. Sometimes it never came through, so they put you at easiness again, and you went back and sat in your ops room, you see. And you went and sat on your dispersal. And waited till another call came through. But a controller on a sector, as I was there controlling the aircraft once they got off the ground. You were told by group to get them up and to fly at, say, Angels 18, which is height 18,000 feet, over a certain place. and wait for further instructions. Now, we used to get the further instructions, then we used to tell them what vector to do, which is the direction that you go, and where to go and what to expect, and the number of the aircraft coming through. Once they had said tally-ho, then I was finished with them altogether and were ready for anybody else going up. And sometimes you had two or three squadrons you had to send up all at the same time. Well, of course, then once they all got into contact, then there was nothing more we could do. Because it wasn't like controlling at Heathrow today, for instance. It wasn't that sort of controlling at all. It was merely controlling them to get into the right position to attack the enemy. So that's what I was doing at Tangmere for 4 or 5 months.
Did the equipment that you had enable you to communicate clearly?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Perfectly clearly, yes, yes. It wasn't RT in those days, you see. It was direct control.
Now, I think that you became the commanding officer of a squadron in February 1940.
That's right, yeah.
Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, it came about because I got fed up with doing nothing. I can't admit. At Tangmere, there were awfully nice people down there, I must admit, and I used to fly their aircraft when I was off duty in the ops room. I got quite a lot of flying in and so on. And there happened to be a chap whose name was Hawtrey, John Hawtrey, who was the headmaster's son at my prep school. Older than me, mind you, so I never met him then, but he knew of me and I knew of him. And he was then the chief fighter command, what did he call himself? No, he won't call himself. He was the personnel officer, and so I went up to London to see him with a suggestion that I was perfectly adequate to command a squadron if there was one available. As I was 30 then, and most of the commanding officers were a bit younger than that. So he said, well, he'll see what he could do. And eventually, in mid-January 1940, I had a posting to command 152 Nyzham Hyderabad Squadron. And they were then stationed at Acklington, just north of Newcastle. And we had a squadron, a section of Spitfires, Spitfire 1s, and we had a section of Gladiators.
Was it called the Nyzham of Hyderabad Squadron because he financed it?
That's true, yes, he did. He financed the Nyzham of Hyderabad Squadron, as it was called in his name, for the whole period of the war.
Did that mean much to you, or was it just a name?
It was just a name at the time, but if we go on much longer now, you'll find that I wrote him a letter when I was out in India later on, and unfortunately didn't get to see him, which I'd hoped to do because of operations at that particular time. I could never get down to it. But I, funnily enough, had three other pilots of mine who were in the 152 squadron with me and were out in India at the same time. So I was thought perhaps we might all go down and meet him down at Hyderabad. But unfortunately, it never came off. But at the time of 1940, I really didn't know anything about him at all, except his headgear, which was our crest. That was about all.
How much flying would a CO do of a squadron in those days?
This depends really on the CO. I think I did as much flying as any other CO. There were a lot of other things one had to do as well as fly, of course, so therefore you were not always down at dispersal when a scramble was called, because you were in your office with your adjutant doing the other work that had to be done. The one thing that I think that I disliked more than anything else was, of course, when one of one's pilots was killed, and in the evening, it happened very many times, the telephone would ring in the mess and the duty pilot would call up that Mr. or Mrs. so-and-so were down below and would you go and see them. They wanted to talk to you. Well, this happened in the morning, so, and they'd got notice of it. That was the worst part of anything, having to talk to them and explain to them what, as far as you knew, what had happened and so on, which I hated doing. That happened pretty frequently.
Now, can you tell me what it was like to fly the Spitfire Mark I?
Beautiful. That and the Hawker Fury, the aircraft, single-seater fighter, were the best two aeroplanes that I've ever flown, and I've flown 67 different types of aeroplane.
What was so good about the Spitfire?
Oh, it was a beautiful aeroplane, beautifully designed, had no nasty bits about it at all. It just flew, and it flew beautifully. It was a lovely aeroplane, it really was. But, of course, the first Spitfire 1, which I had at that sort of particular time, had to have its undercarriage pumped up and down by the pilot. And that was a very tricky manoeuvre, because pumping an undercarriage up and down, and it needed quite a lot of pumps too, and trying to keep the stick still at the same time was not an easy matter. And some people got into trouble over that.
And the Fury?
The Fury was a single pilot aircraft, but it had no things about it like undercarriage or flaps or variable pitch propeller or anything like that. It was just a beautiful little aeroplane. It really was a lovely little aeroplane. Plenty of power. Had the Merlin engine, had plenty of power, and a lovely aeroplane to fly. Those are my favourite two aeroplanes that I've ever flown, I think.
What do you remember about the character of the personnel in your squadron?
I have nothing whatsoever to say against any one member of any pilots that I ever met. I don't think I can be straighter than that. They were a wonderful bunch of people. They never argued about anything. You asked them to do something, they did it straight away. They're a wonderful bunch.
And you said in your squadron you also had the Gladiator?
No, that was up at Accrington. That was in February when I first went up there. We had the section of Gladiators and the section of Spitfires. But as just before Dunkirk came up, I got my full quota of Spitfires. So I became a full squadron. That's probably the reason why we didn't go down to Dunkirk, down to the Channel, because we weren't fully properly trained by that, without the full quantity of aeroplanes, you see.
So you didn't take part in your squadron in the Battle for France?
No, not at all.
If we can go on to the Battle of Britain now, Can you tell me what you remember about its start?
Very difficult to say. Of course, I can remember all sorts of things, but one very foolish little thing, perhaps, it might amuse anybody who's listening to this. I was shot down on a raid on Bristol. And I was hit in the petrol tank, and it flooded out all over me and all over everything, and it also damaged the hood. So I couldn't get out and bail out, which is what I felt I wanted to do. So instead of throttling back, because had I done so with the Merlin engine, it would have spit fire, which is a good name for it, actually, but it did spit fire out of its forward ports. And it was just simply gone up in one big ball of fire. I couldn't have done anything else, actually. Anyway, I switched the switches off, so cut it dead. And then, of course, the next thing I had to do was to force land. And so I did force land, and I force landed in a field beside the railway line between Exeter and Paddington at Frome, Frome. And I came into land there with a dead stick and landed it with the undercarriage up, of course, and skidded along for a short period. And I will swear this, that when I came into land, I can remember seeing the railway line on my left, and I can remember seeing a gate on the far side of a field. And I thought, well, that's all right, because they can get the Spitfire out of here because there's a gate in the field, you see. And I just sort of settled down when suddenly there was a woman on my left with a cup of tea. Now, where the hell she came from, I don't know, because I'll swear there was no car in sight anywhere when I came over the hedge. She was standing on the wing beside the cockpit, the same height as I was, without an undercarriage. She had a cup of tea, already hot, and everything else. I don't know. I still think of this these days, but it's just a funny little incident which happened.
So how representative of the attitude of the public was that to the British fighter pilots taking part in the Battle of Britain?
Well, I think that it was marvellous. I think that the British public did everything they jolly well could. Of course, there was one particular person who was shot at, Nicholson, who got a VC, actually. Well, his story is well known, I think, that he tried to get out because he was on fire, saw a 109 ahead of him, got back in the cockpit again and pressed the button and shot the ME-109 down and bailed out. And coming down into a field, and I can't remember where it was. Now, he was in 72 Squadron, I knew him from that point of view. And on his way down, he was shot at by a farmer in the field with a shot with a 12-bore shotgun, actually, which didn't do him any good, actually, but he was still alive anyway. And he lived till out in Burma. He was out in Burma later on. But whether you want to put that in or not, I don't know, but it's an interesting little point. You ask me what I remember. I can remember all sorts of things, but I think I'd keep you here till 5 or 6 o'clock if I was to go on telling you all the little things.
Do you remember the approximate dates when you were forced to land at Frome?
25th of September 1940, that one was.
And you'd been hit by a German fighter, had you?
No, a bomber. A Dornier 111.
Can you describe the circumstances?
Well, I was leading the squadron down onto the tail end of the I think there were about 100, as far as I can remember, any number of them anyway. And, of course, when you lead the pilots down onto it, you're the first one to go in, so therefore you try and leave room to come in, shoot whatever you can do into the one of the aeroplanes, then break away. And I think we did get quite a few of them down, actually. And then I got shot, of course, on my breaking away, by being as close as I was to breaking away from the squadron.
Presumably that was always the danger point.
Well, you see, so many people, I think that if you're commanding a squadron, you command a squadron like a several ships of in the Navy. You keep in your right positions all the time, but you can't in the air. You've got to get them into position, and then it's all for you.